Today on The Grave Talks, we continue our conversation with Alice Vernon about her new book, Ghosted, A History of Ghost Hunting and Why We Keep Looking. I think it was the Toronto, an investigative group in Toronto, they kind of did that with a seance, and they went into different seances with the same person in mind to see if they would come up in the seance or if they could make contact with this person who never even existed.
It is an experiment that has been done many times, and I have written about it. So there was a magician, and magicians are hated spiritualists. So a lot of scientists
Houdini,
are very skeptical.
Yeah.
Houdini. But yeah, it was the magicians that were, I think, the biggest enemies of spiritualism, because they thought that, you know, spiritualists were doing the same kind of thing as them, but at least a magician was telling their audience, you know, how the tricks were done at the end and that kind of thing, and weren't deliberately deceiving the audience. But there was a magician, and he got, I think, seven of his pals, magician pals, and he said, right, let's all go to a separate seance at the very same time, and we'll all try and ask for the ghost of George Washington to come through. And yeah, in all seven of these seances, George Washington came through at the same time. So unless he is some sort of omnipresent god.
He was George Washington, so maybe.
maybe he could, you know, fragment himself into seven pieces and appear at all of these seances all the time. But yeah, the Toronto thing is quite interesting if you're thinking of the Philip experiment.
Yes.
Where a group of people were asked to make up a historical figure from, I think he's like from the 17th century, he's like a 17th century British aristocrat or something. And it was a proper melodramatic sort of like telenovela, really bad history. It was just completely inaccurate, but that's kind of what they wanted. And he was called Philip. They sat around this seance table and tried to summon the ghost of Philip, and nothing happened for ages and ages and ages, until they sort of went back to older spiritualist, like more traditional ways of conducting a seance. So kind of having a bit of hymns and prayers and light conversation and kind of doing a bit more table tilting and that kind of thing. And for some reason, that triggered all of this phenomena. And it was like Philip, the fictitious character that they'd made up, had actually come to respond to and appear at this seance. So it kind of posed the question of, is a lot of seance phenomena kind of psychological, and was it the group had manifested this fictitious spirit themselves, or was there something else that they had summoned? Da, da, da.
And who really knows?
It freaks me out, that experiment, because it's like, you know, it was done by proper parapsychologists and psychical researchers. It wasn't kind of, you know, it wasn't just like a random group of people. It was a proper scientific experiment, and they got all this crazy phenomena. Really freaks me out.
Now, when did spiritualism kind of move into ghost hunting, or are those really two separate things? Or did ghost hunting kind of become popular? Because there's one case that you write about. It was, I believe, the late 1800s, Record of a Haunted House.
Oh, yeah.
By Miss R.C. Morton. Yes.
Yeah.
And she kept a journal and wrote letters to document this. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that case? Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think ghost hunting, I think there are kind of small cases throughout history where people have kind of gone to investigate an alleged haunting at a monastery or whatever. But it really comes from the whole Sir William Crookes, Florence Cook saga, because his reputation was so tarnished, it actually led to the establishment of the Society for Psychical Research, so that people interested, or scientists interested in spiritualism and ghosts, could band together, and then there'd be kind of safety in numbers, and they could have endorsements and work together and that kind of thing. And so they had these different committees, and one of them was a haunted house committee that was set up specifically. And I think that's really where sort of modern ghost hunting as we know it comes from. And it's fascinating that kind of, you know, one of the earliest proper ghost hunts comes from this young woman who'd lived in this house in Cheltenham in England. You know, she's doing this proper report and she's doing all these little experiments. My favourite experiment that she does, which, bless her, is so pointless, but she tacks a bit of string quite tightly at the bottom of the stairs and leaves it there. And then in the morning, she comes down and sees that the string is unbroken and hasn't been tampered with in any way. And she concludes that the ghost must be translucent because the string didn't break. And I thought, that's quite a wild jump. It's quite a leap in conclusions to make. But it is really interesting. And I think that report and all the other work that the Society for Psychical Research did at that time did influence, I think, the ghost hunts that are still going on today. I mean, as we're recording this, it's almost Halloween, so there's probably all sorts of ghost hunts going on tonight.
And there was another one that was quite famous, was Harry Price.
Oh, yeah.
And is that the Borley Rectory?
Yes. Yeah, Borley Rectory.
And many people have heard of that location. Would you talk a little about that?
Yes, yeah, Harry Price. I have a lot of feelings and opinions about Harry Price. So Harry Price was a professional hobbyist, is how I think I describe him.
So rich.
He was a man of means, and he had a lot of time, and he didn't know what to do with it. So, but he loved publicity, and I think he found that there were always reports about hauntings and poltergeists and ghosts in newspapers. And he thought, aha, publicity. And so he rents out the entirety of this horrible, moldy old rectory in Essex, which had this long history of being haunted, possibly by a nun, and all these residents from the parish kept moving out, and the rectors were moving out all the time, and nobody would stay there very long. So he rented it out for dirt cheap, and he put an advert in the Times newspaper, I think, that was basically like, are you a person of leisure? Do you own a car? Would you like to come and investigate this haunted house? And so he got these people to come, and it was really quite kind of like a militaristic operation, where there were shifts and there was this horrible old camp bed. So, you know, sleep was not encouraged in this rectory. And he did. It was like this proper operation to gather evidence and try and kind of make this rectory this kind of infamous haunted house in England. And he got two books out of it, so, you know, congratulations to him. But yeah, Harry Price, very morally dubious. And it was actually his secretary, Molly Goldney, who worked with his rival, Eric Dingwall, and another man, Trevor Hall. And I think about 7 or 8 years after Harry Price had died, they decided then to write their own book, which was just an expose of all the things that he'd faked and all the ways the investigation was bogus and not done properly. And so they did not want, the reputation of Borley Rectory to just be about Harry Price. You know, they kind of wanted to discredit it a little bit, which it didn't really, because Harry Price is still incredibly famous as a ghost hunter today, and nobody's really heard of Eric Dingwall and Molly Goldney, which is sad because Molly Goldney was very sassy and had lots of gossip, and she was quite fabulous. So I think more people need to be talking about Molly Goldney
more than Harry Price.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, that whole story, though, you could pick that up and set that into 2025. You know, it seems like things like that are going on. There are people who are legit doing investigations and really trying to uncover the science of it, trying to figure things out. There are other people who are doing it for fame or to write a book or, get clicks and views and all of that sort of thing. So I think you still have that same dynamic going on today.
Yeah, I think just as you were saying that, I thought of the Conjuring house.
Right, they're having a lot of drama with that right now.
Yeah, is it some like a YouTuber or something has bought it, and somebody's bought Annabelle, or what? Or is it the same person that's bought Annabelle the doll?
I think so. I think so. Yeah. Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes, it's very interesting, and you know, so I think you're still going to have the conflicted viewpoints, and I'm right. No, I'm right.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's ever going to go away. And, you know, when you look at it historically over the last 200 years, you know, you see elements kind of, I think that the spiritualism movement was kind of fading a little bit, but then World War I happens and it kind of comes back and then it kind of fades out again and this comes out. And I remember in the 90s, it was the psychic hotlines were a huge thing. Miss Cleo, and you could, for like only a dollar a minute, you can, she will solve all of your problems for you.
Yeah, yeah, we had Mystic Meg in the UK.
You had the exact same thing. Or, you know, in a much darker thing, the Satanic Panic here. I don't know if that really happened much in the UK.
Well, I think I talk about it a little bit in Ghosted, but I think, so the US was having the Satanic Panic and Ed and Lorraine Warren were barging into people's homes and renouncing Satan and all the rest of it. And I think at the same time, we were having a similar sort of thing, but it was to do with poltergeists more so. And it was because we were suffering under Margaret Thatcher, who had let a lot of the council houses, so kind of like social housing provision, had let a lot of that just turn to mouldy ruin. And so a lot of the free social housing for working class people or for single mothers with children or whatever, those houses were disgusting and it was really awful to be forced to live in one. And so you get quite a lot of poltergeist cases, like the Enfield poltergeist, which was, you know, in a council house. And it's often, you know, a moment of upheaval for these families or a moment of distress. You know, they're not in a council house by choice necessarily. And so you get these poltergeist cases strike up where young children are so distressed by all the upheaval and the change in routine and the not very nice house that they live in. Suddenly, you know, pots and pans start banging around and that kind of thing. So I think that was kind of happening at the same time as the Satanic Panic, but that was our kind of version at the same time.
Our version of it, I would say, was more of a hysteria. You know, it was, there was a lot of about what music the kids were listening to and all this, but then they were also going after people in daycares and you're doing these horrific things to our children in these daycares and they ruin people's lives. And they were in court for years fighting these charges. And they were so disgraced, they never did get their reputations back, despite the fact they were never proven guilty of any of it. So it was kind of a hysteria too.
I think, because I read a couple of books written by and about Ed and Lorraine Warren, and you know, I've seen the Conjuring films and I think they're quite camp and fabulous and you know they're quite fun to watch really, but I think what they don't show those films is actually how problematic the Warrens were. I think I talk about a case where it's a teenager, Cindy, and she's obviously not very happy at home. Her parents sound awful. And she's just a teenager, you know, she wants to do stuff and read, you know, weird books and all that kind of stuff. And her parents get the Warrens in because they think she's possessed. And there's a bit, and I'll misquote this, but it's something like, oh, a doctor or a psychiatrist diagnosed Cindy with anxiety or depression or whatever. And then they say, but we know better. Oh, my God. Awful.
You know, and there are two people, Ed and Lorraine Warren, that also are very polarizing. There are people who really believe in the work they did, and other people are like, they were in it for the fame. So even they're quite controversial, really.
They kind of seem like the Harry Price of the US, although I think the Warrens are far more problematic. I think Harry Price was just a bit of an arrogant man, whereas I think Ed and Lorraine Warren, at least in my opinion, I think they did do some damage to teenagers. So,
but
you know.
I also don't think that tarnished their reputation after, you know, they've been gone. You know, there's still people, I don't even think, that are aware of some of the things like
that.
Yeah,
and I think the Conjuring films perhaps haven't helped with that, right, in that people think that is exactly how they were. And I don't think that it's particularly accurate, because they kind of show them as like superheroes, and, you know, they're very action-packed films, and they're always trying to save, you know, whoever's genuinely being hurt by there's no kind of sense that they're you know, doing it for fame and all that kind of thing, whereas, you know, there are so many books that Ed and Lorraine Warren wrote and had written about them, and they did all these college tours and
yes,
all sorts of things. So yeah, I think people need to read up about them a bit more.
Yeah, because I interviewed someone who had written a book about a case in the 70s, I believe it was. Same thing, the daughter's basically being possessed. They are not sure what's going on. Ed and Lorraine Warren get called in, and suddenly hundreds of people are camping out in front of their house because Ed Warren goes on the radio to discuss this case. So it turned it into this circus when all the family wanted was help.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Enfield Poltergeist was exactly the same.
Yes.
You know, it was a young girl who was obviously struggling and, you know, was unhappy. And the newspapers got involved. The BBC came in, and it just became a monster, I think. And there was all this expectation for phenomena to happen.
In the course of writing this book, you go out, you become a certified paranormal investigator. You do a chapter on haunted objects, and I'm guessing it was like for the research you bought a haunted doll.
Would you like, I know this doesn't have a video, but would you like to see Bev?
I would absolutely love
so that
to see
the listeners can hear you gasp in horror. So here's Bev.
I can't totally gasp in horror, but I don't like that type of doll either.
She's sweet. She looks like Doris Day. She's got a little gingham.
Well, Doris Day, like in her younger years, like when she would play 18.
And she blinks.
She
does normally
blink.
There's a bit of
and
ASMR.
She looks like an older doll. Is she porcelain?
No, she's plastic.
Okay.
But she seems kind of 1950s.
She does.
To me.
She does. Yes.
I think she's quite sweet. So she lives in my office. And we had a couple of months ago, we did like an open day, which is a big campus tour, kind of come and look at the department and decide whether you want to come and study with us. So it's for kind of 17, 18 year olds who are still in school to come and decide whether they want to come and study at Aberystwyth. And my boss, who's very long suffering, and she just finds me weird, but in a slightly endearing way, I think. She sighs at me a lot. She said, "Alice, can you bring Bev to the Meet the Department lecture that we're going to do and read a little bit from Ghosted?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course." So I read the bit about Bev from the book, and I had Bev. And at the end, there was this queue of mostly parents, weirdly, all wanting to shake Bev's hand like she was Don Corleone in The Godfather.
And you're like, but I wrote the book, not Bev.
I know. Bev is a celebrity, except there was one student, potential student's mum, who was so horrified by Bev that she complained to my boss and said there should have been prior warning about Bev. And that she was not happy. So Bev, she's quite notorious now in the department. She's a bit of a celebrity. She's just been on the university TikTok account.
Oh, I like that.
She's a big name on campus.
So when you decide you want to buy a haunted object, did you go to Facebook? Did you go to eBay?
I went to eBay, Wild West of very haunted objects. I go on it quite often because it's really fun to see the nonsense that people put up for an extortionate price because they say it's haunted. The other day I found a haunted egg cup. A little haunted egg cup. I found a pair of haunted gym trousers, leggings. And then I found a pair of, as you'd call them sneakers, but a pair of haunted trainers. So I'm trying to, if I get them, I could build up like a haunted gym outfit. And I think that would be really good.
I really would like to know the backstory to haunted leggings.
I know, it's horrible.
I put them on and my legs started doing weird things on their own.
It's very Stephen King. Yeah, right? But imagine dying and then realizing that death is not the end and there is an afterlife, but now you're stuck haunting a pair of leggings.
Or an egg cup. Or Bev. But haunted dolls is definitely a thing. I mean,
yeah,
you know, everybody talks about haunted dolls. So I'm going to guess when you went on eBay, there had to have been quite a selection.
There were hundreds.
Did Bev just kind of speak to you or how did you decide?
She did. So I did actually pull, this is my sort of teaching excellence. I did pull eBay up in a session when I was teaching my students and I was like, right, gang, I've got a mission for you.
Excellence in teaching.
Here we go. Let's not talk about creative writing. Let's talk about eBay and haunted dolls. And they wanted me to get a haunted Aragorn doll from The Lord of the Rings, which... I politely declined.
Yeah.
I know. But Bev, aesthetically, I don't like those sorts of Victorian ringletty frilly dress. I don't like.
My mother has a huge collection of those always freaked me out. I don't like them. That's probably why I don't like them, because they've stared at me my entire life.
I don't know if they freak me out. I just don't like them.
No matter where you are in the room, they are looking at you.
Yeah. So I didn't want one of those. I didn't want a massive one. And also some people are selling haunted dolls for a ridiculous amount of money as well. And Bev is, she's quite small. She's probably about, I don't know, what's that, 10 inches or something. So she's quite small. She's portable, which is very useful.
That's nice.
And she wasn't that expensive. So
did she come with... I don't know what you would call it, like haunted documentation, a backstory,
So she came with this laminated information sheet that was done on sort of fake old paper, you know, like in school projects where you dip a piece of paper into
make it sepia looking,
to make it look old, and they'd laminated it. And I think I describe it in the book as like when you adopt an animal from a rescue shelter and it's like nervous temperament, cannot be housed with young children, right, and that kind of thing. Must be the only haunted doll in the house. And it had all this information. It said that her name was Bev and that she was a very kind church-going lady and that she looked after orphaned foxes, which I found very specific.
That's very specific.
It's very orphaned foxes.
I have never even come across an orphaned fox.
No, what does that even mean? I just thought that was hilarious. So, yeah, Bev, I have never regretted buying Bev. She's worth every penny. My mum thinks I need to get her insured. she's become quite a personality. It's interesting. I don't believe she's haunted in any
That was my next
measure.
Question, obviously. How do you feel like once she came into your house?
Well, I think when I first got her, I was like, what have I done? But actually, other people's reactions to her, she's developed a personality. So it's almost like she has become haunted by a spirit just by people interacting with her and being freaked out by her and her going on the university's official TikTok and all this kind of stuff. People know about Bev and they want to come and meet Bev and they want to come in my office and see her and all that kind of thing. So it is like she has this actual haunting personality to her now. So yeah, she's having a great time.
And I have to tell you, Alice, you seem very connected to her.
In a weird kind of way.
So maybe she is kind of haunted and she's drawing you in.
Maybe. Like, I did think the other day, I'd be devastated if I lost her or if she got stolen.
I was just going to ask you, do you think you could give her away? Like, no. If somebody said, I'm going to give you £100 for that doll, you would say, no. And you go, never. And they go, 200, 300, 500 pounds. And you would say, No.
I love Bev. I'm very, well, I'm just, I get attached to anything with a face on it. I'm dreadful. You know, if it's got a face, if it even looks like it has a face on it, I get attached to it.
It's like she needed you. You needed her a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah. She compliments my personality. I keep asking my boss if we can get her on the payroll.
Oh, that would be nice.
Directly into my account.
Exactly.
Because I have to manage her money. So I think, you know,
it's worth asking.
Get her a pension.
Yes. So from when you started writing the book and your intention was more of a humorous book, then you dove into all of this from the spiritualism up to, you know, Ed and Lorraine Warren and beyond. Did your views change or did it end up in an unexpected place? Sometimes I find I write comedies, but frequently when I start writing, it doesn't always end up where I intended it to end up. It kind of changes as it goes. And especially with this, as you do research, did your opinion kind of change as you went along?
Yeah, it's interesting, especially because this is my second book. Night Terrors went exactly the way I thought it would go. You know, I planned it. I'm going to talk about my sleep disorders and I'm going to research them and I'm going to talk about it. And nothing changed, you know. But with Ghosted, yeah, it was definitely an unexpected change in how I felt about ghost hunting, but also how I felt about belief in spiritualism that I didn't necessarily share, and that it's not right, or I personally don't feel it's right to be so aggressive in dismissing other people's beliefs, in a way that I do see some people are. You know, I look at forums and groups and YouTube comments and that kind of thing, and some people get really aggressive, and I think it's more complicated than that, unless we're talking about Ed and Lorraine Warren, who I just have no time for at all. No time for them. But, you know, in terms of grief, in terms of spiritualism, it is about community. It's about the social side of things. It's about experiencing history. So, I think it changed. I don't think it changed my skepticism necessarily, but I think it softened the edges of it a little bit.
Maybe. I like that. Because I think when you look back on spiritualism, especially from where we're at now, technology has changed so much that these people were experiencing this and going to seances and things, and it was primarily to connect with loved ones who had passed. We still want that connection. That has not changed. At all.
And you can't make fun of that. And, you know, there was a case I read about where a woman who'd been grieving the loss of her son in the First World War finally felt able to stop wearing mourning dress and to stop being isolated. You know, she started writing letters to her friends and things like that. So, yes, you could say that she was attending these fraudulent seances, but it meant something to her, and you can't dismiss that necessarily.
Yeah. I know when I lost my father, it was, I realized eventually I had to be able to let the grief go.
Yeah.
That I was holding on to the grief because that was connecting me to my dad. And if I let go of that, the connection was somehow gone.
Yeah.
And that took me a while to realize what I was doing. And it's kind of, I get why people do that. I get why you would go to a seance. I get why you go to a psychic.
I think you have connection. To look at it. You have to look at it from your own grief, I think, because it seems to me that the spiritualist seances are very warm and welcoming. And I think what they do is they turn crushing grief into that celebration of a person's life, because it brings them back into the room, and you know, you're celebrating them in life rather than grieving the absence of them. So yeah, it is important, I think.
Well, I think the book was wonderful. It reads so easily. I like history, so there's a lot of interesting history in there, as well as you wrote it in a very clever way.
Oh,
it's yeah, it's very well written. It's Ghosted, A History of Ghost Hunting and Why We Keep Looking. And you can buy it wherever books are sold. I just downloaded it onto my Kindle. But Alice, congratulations on the book. And I can't wait to have you back so we can dive into night terrors and sleep paralysis.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much for having me, Carol.
And that wraps up our conversation with Alice Vernon about her new book, Ghosted, A History of Ghost Hunting and Why We Keep Looking. You can find it wherever books are sold. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes, everything commercial free, you could become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts or go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us here at The Grave Talks, thank you so much for listening.